This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when the Milwaukee Bucks begin their playoff series against the Bulls this weekend, one woman will be keeping the players and fans hyped for the game, DJ Shauna. We caught up with her this week and asked her what it means to be the Bucks' official producer and DJ. Now, breaking news, Democrats and Republicans kind of agree on something. Both parties in Congress have put forward bills aimed at boosting access to affordable, high-quality childcare, which is hard to come by for many Americans. A recent poll found that just over a third of Americans struggle to find childcare when adults need to work. While they disagree on how to go about it and pay for it, both the Republican and Democratic proposals want to increase the portion of Americans who get subsidized or free childcare and increase the supply of childcare available. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your childcare situation? Are you able to afford childcare? Did you or your partner have to stay home for it to work, whether you wanted to or not? What might help you the most as a parent? If you work in childcare, what do things look like from your side of things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ruth Schmidt is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. Ruth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's good to be here.
What are we seeing from the two parties in Congress, first of all, on the accessible and affordable childcare issue?
So I think I'd open by saying the first thing we're seeing is probably the closest we've come in as many years as I've been working in this field, which is over 20, to actually see bipartisanship happening when it comes to childcare. I think there is a strong understanding in our country, and it became more and more clear throughout the pandemic that childcare is critical. It's a market failure. We need to do something to stand it up, to support working parents. I think how the Republicans and the Democrats come at it are slightly different, but I think there's significant room to come together. And some significant room for optimism in this.
Before we dig into some of the details in Congress, let's bring things home to Wisconsin. Can you paint us a picture of the childcare landscape here in the state? What is working? Where do we have some room to improve?
So I'm going to actually focus on where we have room to improve because I think there's a lot of small incremental things that are working. I think we've seen throughout COVID, Wisconsin invest significant amounts of COVID relief dollars that came for childcare, which I think point to models and mechanisms that could be in place in the future that would help to really support a system of early care and education. But when I typically talk about early care and education, it's from the vantage point of understanding that we have an incredible gap between the children who need regulated care outside of the home and care that is available in the state of Wisconsin. So prior to the pandemic, we had a gap of about 40% in terms of care available. So we had over 117,000 children under the age of five with all available parents and guardians in the workforce who could not secure regulated care outside of the home. The impact on this is being felt across our state in urban areas, in rural areas. It looks very different from one place to another, but everyone is experiencing that increasingly parents are struggling to work, businesses have job openings for over 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. The Bipartisan Policy Center indicates that the economic impact of the gap in care in Wisconsin hovers between $2.8 and $4 billion annually. So significant losses in our economy because we have this incredible shortage of available care for our youngest kids.
Can you talk about this more as a workplace issue? We hear again and again, we don't have enough people to fill positions in jobs around the state and around the country. But a lot of families, I was here, you know, when my kids were little, you weigh how much would you pay for childcare versus how much do you make going for work? Sometimes it makes more economic sense not to work. Is that part of your selling point to take action on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're hitting at a really good point here. And this is what really, when we talk about market failure, this is it, right? So we know that there are parents out there that are demanding care, that need care, and simply don't have the income to purchase the care that they need to be able to work, right? When childcare is hovering at approximately $10,000 to $12,000 a year in Wisconsin, depending on the age of your child, depending on which market you're in, not many households can easily make that kind of payment for care. It's chewing up upwards of 15 to 30% of median household incomes, depending on what market you're in. At the same time, you've got providers that want to be able to fill the necessary gap, right? They want to be able to provide care. They want to be able to meet the need of children and families in their communities. They want to be able to support the economy. But they can't do it because they can't charge any more money, right? And so you've got these two forces, revenue and demand versus availability and cost. And it simply is not working for many, many families. And then what we see in childcare itself is that three quarters of childcare programs are currently trying to hire people. So we have open classrooms that are sitting vacant because programs can't hire staff. They've reduced hours, they've increased wait lists. And when you look at this workforce and you see that they're earning close to poverty level wages, high levels of reliance on public assistance, despite having education, despite having years of service, we really are in a fragile place when it comes to sustaining care and meeting the needs of working parents at a place where they can afford to have their children.
Talking to Ruth Schmidt, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, about childcare shortfalls in terms of accessibility and affordability in Wisconsin and beyond, efforts in Congress to try to help close that gap. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dave is with us in Toma. Dave, hello.
Yeah, hi. I've just got two quick points to make, and then you can talk about it off the air. One is, I just don't have a lot of sympathy. If people, why are people having kids they can't afford? That's my first, my starting point. I don't have a lot of sympathy. And the other one is, the standards for child care have gotten ridiculously high. And if we lowered the standards to where they were back in the 70s, where there was a lot of people offering private daycare and things, the cost would come down and it wouldn't be such an issue.
Dave, thanks for the call. Ruth, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think first I'd say it's pretty common to hear this question about families having children that they can't afford. I think the one thing I'd want to point out on that is in Wisconsin, we lead the nation in babies with mothers in the workforce. Now, this isn't, so the national average of babies with moms in the workforce is about 61%. And in Wisconsin, it is over 70% of babies have moms in the workforce. This isn't necessarily because just because moms want to work. This is a function of sort of the reality of our economic system, right? We already have a workforce shortage in Wisconsin. And if we were to take women out of the workforce to be home with children when they're young without replacing it with something, I think all it would do is make the current economic situation, the current workforce issues that we're struggling with, that much worse. I don't think anyone is saying what is right or wrong for a family. That is obviously something that should be left up to families. But the economic reality of our country and our state in many, many cases is that you have all available parents in the workforce in order to make household function and in order to help our economy function and the workforce as a whole in Wisconsin. So that's the one thing I'd say about that. And then in terms of lowering standards, I can tell you that this is one that sort of always gets my it gets me on edge when I hear people talking about this, because the bulk of brain development is happening with children under the age of three. This is when like 80 to 90% of the architecture of the brain is developing, language is developing, social emotional skills, which are the foundation for all future learning, are developing. this is a time when we need our children to be in the best possible care with educated early childhood educators working with them, caring for them, providing developmentally appropriate care for those kids. This has been studied up one side and down the other in terms of what is best for children, what is best for their long-term health, what's best for success in school. And if you talk to people that work in the workforce of early care and education, I think you would hear over and over again, please do not water down the standards and the requirements, because what we do is so important. And we need to have the protections we have in place, and we need to have the adult-to-child ratios that we have in place in order to do our jobs well.
Thanks for the call, Dave. We're talking to Ruth Schmidt, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, talking about bills in Congress that, if passed, would make childcare more affordable and accessible. That's their goal anyway. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in childcare, what do you wish people knew about your job? What are your thoughts on the levels of pay and compensation? If you need childcare as a parent, what are you seeing out there? What are you not seeing out there right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Ruth Schmidt, the executive director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. We're talking about proposals from both sides of the aisle to make childcare more accessible and affordable. Still time for your calls with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences working in childcare, looking for childcare. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now with Dana in Appleton. Dana, hello.
Hello. So I'm a single mother that I work part-time and I go to school, and I have two children, one of school age and one that's 3 years old. And they're currently at a daycare that is charging me $1,800 a month for a full-time kid, 3 years old, and a kid who's there for 5 hours a week. And they know how much I get for state aid, or, you know, before any of the situation happened of me, you know, it being transferred in my name and everything like that. And it's almost like I feel like the daycare center almost knew how much I was going to get, and like they charge more than what that is. It's just crazy. And then to find another daycare center that is willing to take a kid of my age, of their ages, and there's a waiting list that's so long, I don't know if I'm going to be able to work because of that.
Dana, thanks a lot for the call. Ruth, that's this kind of story I'm guessing you hear fairly often.
We do hear that story very often, and thanks for the comments, Dana. And I think this points to the need for one of these bills, either the Republican bill, the Democratic bill, or some compromise between the two for us to move something forward so that individuals in Dana's situation have access to affordable care. I think what's tricky about these situations, we have a shortage of care in Wisconsin. We have waiting lists in childcare programs, in some cases up to 6 months to a year. The running joke is, as soon as you find out you're pregnant, you need to get on a waiting list so that you have your care available when you give birth to that baby. This is a huge issue, Dana. And The perspectives are in tension with each other, right? Like, I hear you. I definitely hear how hard it is to have to face making that type of a payment every month. When we look at how childcare programs operate, the margins are razor thin. No one is making money in this industry. If they were, we wouldn't have a shortage of it, right? Like, if this were a business model that worked, we would have no shortage of childcare programs because we would open them and they would operate successfully. But even though $1,800 a month sounds astronomically high, when you figure that into the cost of operating a childcare program, paying mortgages, utilities, insurance, food, supply, curriculum, materials that you need for your classrooms, let alone staff, you find out that there's just not enough left over. So there's no good answers, honestly, without a significant public solution to this. And by public, I mean a government solution to ensuring that there's tax dollars that are going in to support childcare in a bigger way for working families.
Dana, thanks for that call and good luck to you. Before we go back to our callers, Ruth, can you talk more now about what is in those Democratic and Republican plans? Some of the key items that you might, that there's some overlap even, that might help out with that situation you just outlined.
Yeah. So I think the encouraging things that we see in both the Republican and the Democratic proposals are hoping to get to a cap on the amount of household income that would need to be paid for care, and that cap would be at no more than 7% of household income. It differs in terms of, for the Republicans, their bill would sort of cap out with families at approximately $142,000 nationally. That would be the national average. And for Democrats, it goes up to about $240,000 of household income. So more families served under the Democratic bill, fewer families served under the Republican bill, but the Republican bill, as it is presented, would go a long way to supporting many, many more families and income-constrained families in Wisconsin. The other pieces that are similar is that both are built on this desire to have family choice, parent choice as to want, where you want your child to be in care. The pieces that I think are problematic to me in the Democratic bill, or in the Republican bill rather, they haven't put a price tag on it, so we have no assurances of what they're willing to actually come to the table with in terms of dollars for this project. It would be a continuation of the Child Care Development Block Grant that's existed for many years. Wisconsin uses that to support subsidy for people who need it in Wisconsin. The Democratic bill, what I like about it, many things, but one is that it also includes a very targeted increase in wages for people that work in this field so that we could hopefully turn the corner on shortages of workforce coming into this field. We could get them the training they need. They could get benefits. They could be paid commensurate with their levels of education. So lots of good stuff in both, slightly different ways of achieving it.
Talking to Ruth Schmidt from the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, looking at a child care gap in Wisconsin and around the country, some plans in Congress aimed at tackling that problem. Back to your calls now. Shalina is with us in Appleton. Shalina, hello.
Hello. I am an elementary school teacher, and our school has recently provided public 3K and 4K classrooms. Watching what goes on in the classroom and the struggles that we are having, I see some frustrations with that. And after living in Germany for 3 or 4 years, I noticed that in Europe, you have the families are far more empowered because of the family leave and child care income credits and those to support the families to be able to have that time with their children at home and not be forced to work and to have to put your kids in child care. And I just wonder if we can move this political conversation from providing universal child care into what can we do to provide parents the best options for them.
Shalina, thanks a lot for that call. Ruth, could that be part of the solution, more family leave so that a parent doesn't have to make that choice between do I go back to work or pay for child care or not?
Yes, I think it should definitely be part of the conversation that we're having, but I think that's a harder part of the conversation. And lots of European countries get this done well. They provide that type of support for parents upon the birth or adoption of a child. So you've got some time to be away and be with your child and bonding and everything that you want to do as a new parent. They also provide considerably public supported options for childcare when it is time to be back at work, right? So they do it correct on two different levels. In our country, I think we're struggling with both, right? We don't have a decent level of paid family leave that's required to support moms and dads when they have children. And we certainly don't have the supports that we need when it comes to the childcare infrastructure. The other thing that I would just really briefly say is when you're talking about children coming into four-year-old kindergarten, we often hear from four-year-old kindergarten teachers in Wisconsin that they can tell the difference between children that are coming out of high-quality childcare, having had that benefit and being ready to learn when they hit those classrooms, which to me is just another thing I think that speaks to the value of investing correctly in the care that our young children do get.
In just our last half a minute or so, Ruth, are you optimistic that something is going to come out of Congress between these two plans?
I am optimistic that something will come out. I will be probably the first to say I hope it can go a lot further than I think it's going to go, but I am optimistic that it's going to be better than what we had in past years.
Ruth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Ruth Schmidt, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. She talked to us today about two bills aimed at making affordable childcare more accessible to more Americans. One plan from Republicans in Congress, one plan for Democrats. As we heard, a fair amount of overlap. There is still time for you to share your thoughts or maybe your experiences or your solutions. You can do that. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you think. You can also always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Dig past the headlines on the top Wisconsin news of the day on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent every weekday morning. Tomorrow at 8, a lot of districts saw votes on school funding around the state, including one close recount. Find out what happened and what it means for schools and students, and maybe join in with a report for what's going on in your own community when it comes to school funding. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. A while back, I mentioned the strange home remedies that we sometimes get as kids, like I got Coke syrup for stomach aches and Werner's ginger ale for everything else. Seems like a pretty common theme. A lot of my Central Time chums had similar experiences. Well, I asked you if you had anything like that. Here's an email from Anne in Madison. Anne writes, as a kid, I was always given a teaspoon of granulated sugar for hiccups, which worked every time. So a spoonful of sugar does have some medicinal benefits. Anne goes on, another recommended cure for hiccups was to drink water while upside down. I think you're supposed to bend over at the waist and drink, but could never quite work out the logistics of this, so don't know if that works. I've heard that one too, Anne. Never quite figured it out either. I try to help other people out with their hiccups by scaring them, but it's a thin line between not scary enough and too scary. How do you cure your hiccups? What works for you? What wisdom have you tried that failed? Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. If you're dealing with hiccups right now, boo! Always happy to help out. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer. Coming up, a report from the White House calls on Congress to take legislative action to support Native American voting rights. We'll look at some of the unique challenges facing Native American voters around the country. Now at a Milwaukee Bucks game, if you want music to get you pumped up, who are you going to call? Giannis Antetokounmpo knows.
Who's your favorite DJ, Giannis?
Oh, you. DJ Sun, by far. Not even close. She was in the All-Star game. All the best players in the world. She was right there, DJ. That's how you know she's the best.
Shauna Nichols, also known as DJ Shauna, is the official DJ and producer for the Milwaukee Bucks. She recently DJed for the NCAA Women's Final Four basketball tournament, as well as for the NBA All-Star Game and the Ryder Cup. Shauna previously opened for Lizzo at Summerfest and played basketball at UW-Madison. I talked to her earlier this week about what it means to be a major sports DJ. Well, can you tell us about your job as DJ and producer for the Bucks? What goes into that and how much fun is it?
So much fun. It's hard to put it into a concise sort of brief synopsis for you though on what goes into it, but we'll simplify it to game days. So as soon as you walk into Fiserv, we've got music pumping My job has started long before that, actually. So I've already probably been in the building for maybe four and a half hours in meetings, you know, making sure we're ready for the game. I've already prepped a couple hours pregame for everything that we're going to do in the show. And I'm already DJing for the Milwaukee Bucks that are out on the court doing their pregame warmups before fans even enter the building. But when you scan your ticket and enter the building, the hopes is that it's a party vibe, that you're there, you know, it's a basketball game, especially with playoffs coming up now, being the defending champions. The energy is just contagious. And once the ball gets tipped, to be honest, everything that you hear audio wise that's not a video really is coming from me. So I'm pushing some buttons, turning some knobs, and just really constantly, we just don't stop at Fiserv.
As you're planning a set list for a night, what is different about a sports event like a Bucks game, for example, versus a club or a party?
Totally different. It's a different experience. And so the demographic that, honestly, that especially in Milwaukee is so diverse. It's one of my favorite things about being the Bucks DJ, especially being in the Deer District last playoffs and finals. When you look out there, like, that's the Milwaukee that I love. That's the Milwaukee that I love to be a part of. And so imagine trying to make 100,000 people happy who aren't there for you as a show. They're there to support the Milwaukee Bucks. And so it's a tricky little game that you have to try to play between every sort of type of music, really, for every single person out there. And so it's very different from a club or a bar or a festival set, candidly, that I've done. And where club, bar, festival set, that's like your show, you know, like that's about me. But when I've been an athlete my whole life, and so when I am going to a Bucks game, I'm a part of a team and I'm a part of something that's bigger than me. And this isn't my show. And it's not about me. It's not about the songs that I want to play or I want to hear. This is not only about the, you know, the guys that are in uniform on the court, but this is about Milwaukee, and this is about something way bigger than me. So a lot of those nerdy things that I think about kind of go into that.
All right, now you're the perfect person to ask a dumb question, I wonder, when I'm in the stands, you know, at a sporting event, and the athletes are down there, and there's a song that's getting me pumped up, and I'm thinking, is it getting the, you know, the players pumped up, or have they just tuned everything out? Now, you've been on the court. You played for the UW-Madison women's basketball team, and you're a DJ now. Like, do you, when you're on the court, do you hear what the DJ is doing? Do you hear what's playing in the arena?
I'm old enough to where we didn't have a DJ. And so my job actually didn't exist when I was playing at Wisconsin as a Badger and even overseas as a professional. And so my job wasn't even around. So that's something that is just like enamors me, is I get into the arena and I'm like, this is just so crazy, like knowing both sides of the game and soaking it all in. But from what I have gathered, it's not about the music pregame, I think, a little bit, like they hear it there. It's more about what the music does to the people that are in the arena there to support the guys. That's the energy that is felt. So this, I think, this really cool symbiotic relationship where we all need each other to be successful NBA champions.
Now we're headed into the NBA playoffs. At last year's finals, you got a chance to spin your own record. I want to listen to a clip of the track. It's called
Thank
I Won't
you.
Give Up. It features the artist Tanner Howe. Can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to craft this tune?
Oh, Rob, that brings tears to my eyes every time I get to hear that. I'm sorry. Like, I'm very sincere. It's very surreal. So Tanner, whose vocals you heard on there, we went through this project during the pandemic, and we never met, actually. Everything we did was over the computer. Tanner is an incredible singer-songwriter out in L.A., and he and I share the same management, and that's how this kind of happened, is I want to start putting more of my own music out there, more of like stuff like that, that hopefully makes people bob their heads and smile and inspires and gives them hope. So honestly, like, without sounding too cheesy, that was written during a pandemic, and I was sitting, you know, right here where I am right now talking to you, having a conversation again, face-to-face with Tanner over a computer, and saying, like, I want to write this for people who, like, I want to hit as many things as we possibly can. So, like, for me, I think I like to hustle, and I like to set goals and have these dreams and aspirations that seem so absurd and unreachable and just work my butt off in silence and do it and then move on to the next thing. And I was like, but I also want to write it because we're also in the middle of a pandemic and this is like really, really hard. And I miss my family and there's people that I can't see. And we're also going through one of the biggest social justice movements in our lifetime. That is just so important to remind people that Black Lives Matter. And I want people, I want everybody to feel this. I want this to be, maybe somebody feels this in a relationship. Maybe somebody feels this when they look in the mirror when they're brushing their teeth in the morning. And so honestly, that's a lot of different people, but I wanted it to hit home. And I wrote it for you. I wrote it for people that, you know, want to make the world a little bit of a better place in their own way.
And DJ Shauna, the defending champion Milwaukee Bucks, start a playoffs this weekend against the Bulls. What are you doing to get ready?
Man, I'm sleeping. but I'm already ready. I mean, that was the coolest thing. Like yesterday for me, I had just Sunday, I had gotten back. I got to work the women's U.S. national soccer game in Columbus.
Nice.
Friendly game against Uzbekistan. And so I got back and had brunch with my family, took a nap, and then I was all day just watching to see what was going to play out, especially in the Eastern Conference, and to see, you know, where we were going to fall, who we get to play. And I'm just excited. And I think I read some stuff on Twitter from the Bucks squad, and coach walked out of the press room and he, you know, publicly very rarely raises his voice and he yelled, "It's playoffs, baby." And that's like the vibe. It's like, all right, let's go. Like, this is it.
All right. Well, have a great series, Shauna. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate y'all very much. I hope you have a great spring. Stay healthy, and Bucks in six.
That was Shauna Nichols, also known as DJ Shauna, the official DJ and producer for the Milwaukee Bucks. She joined me just after her DJing duties for the NCAA Women's Final Four basketball tournament and a U.S. Women's National Soccer Team friendly, talking about her work for the Bucks. I spoke to her earlier this week. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a mother's tea.
Many of us grew up questioning our parents' methods and traditions, only to find ourselves embracing them later in life. That was definitely the case for writer Yeo Lore. She tells us about the skepticism and love of her mother's tea.
When I would get sick, my mother would rummage through the cabinets, pulling out crinkled Ziploc bags filled with twisted roots that once clung to the earth, golden leaves touched by King Midas, and of course, the trusty old Chopa Jay. The Chopa Jay was our family's medicine rock. This white, clay-like crystal my mother would scrape into a powder before boiling it into a tasteless tea. Then she'd order me to drink and ask no questions. I had many. I drank anyway. My mother comes from a long line of healers. Her father was a shaman who traveled between both worlds. She is an herbalist who interprets dreams. I happen to be the skeptic of all things. When I was 8, I lost one of my front teeth. Months went by and still no tooth. "How did you throw it away?" my mother asked, because you see, there's a special way of disposing of one's tooth. If you lose a tooth along the top, you must hold the tooth up to your forehead and let it fall into the garbage. Our teeth at the top grow down, so the tooth must also go down. My mother did not witness how I had thrown the tooth away and became concerned. One day she said, "When we go to the garden, bring an apple." Across our garden was a grassy field, and in that field lived a horse. I was instructed to offer the apple to the horse and say, "Horsey, horsey, my tooth will not grow back. May I have one of your teeth, please?" Shortly after that, it grew back. I remained a skeptic. I was embarrassed by my mother's unconventional ways. Many times I demanded to see the label of her ingredients. My mother said her chua didn't come with labels. She would say, "Bei Meng Huli Na, we Hmong call it this." And this never seemed to have a good translation. For example, chua guta hao literally means medicine hot head. When you Google it, it pulls up hot flashes and menopause, which I don't think I was experiencing at 15. I refused to drink my mother's chua from then on. The following 10 years, I did what most everybody does. I went to the doctor. Sometimes I was told to go home and let things heal on their own, take some Advil, apply this cream, here's some antibiotics. Something was always missing, though. I started to explore how others healed themselves and became fascinated with rocks, these everyday things that could be a billion years old. Imagine the stories they must hold. I wondered if that was what my mother thought when she untangled roots or collected leaves for another herbal concoction. During my rock phase, I learned about selenite, known as a healing stone. It's sometimes sold in thin, long slabs. I ordered one for myself, and when it arrived, I noticed it was soft, a bit dull, and somewhat chalky. That's when I realized I had seen this before, in my mother's kitchen. The trusty old chopaje, the tasteless tea I drank as a child, this was it, just in a different form. I was babysitting my nephew when he lost a tooth. He wanted to put it under his pillow for some tooth fairy money. "Bud," I said, "do you want tooth fairy money, or do you want your tooth to grow back?" There we stood in front of the garbage bin. Sometimes the universe has its way of leading you back to your mother's tea.
That story came to us from Yia Lore, a writer who lives in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll learn more about a report released by the White House last month that highlights the disparities Native Americans still face when trying to vote. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The White House released a report this past March on Native American voting rights. The report called on Congress to pass legislation that would increase voting accessibility. It cited multiple barriers that some Native Americans face when trying to vote, including language barriers, cultural disrespect, and outright hostility, among others. The report comes a year after President Biden issued an executive order on promoting access to voting, which included the creation of the Interagency Steering Group on Native American Voting Rights. Over the last year, the steering group met with tribal leaders and Native Americans around the country. This report is a result of those meetings. Jacqueline De Leon is an enrolled member of the Isleta Pueblo and a staff attorney for the Native American Rights Fund. Jacqueline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you talk about some of the unique barriers and obstacles that Native Americans still face after, in many cases, decades of legal challenges? What are some of the biggest problems out there still today?
Sure. So I kind of think of this in two different buckets. The first bucket is the structural problems that Native Americans face across this country. Often, it's no surprise to folks that Native American reservations are remote. They're a little bit more rural. But what we're seeing is that those homes on the reservations often lack addresses. They lack access to residential mail delivery, even lacking access to residential mail delivery relative to other rural Americans. And they have poor road conditions and unfortunately, poverty. And all of those conditions make things like travel to a polling place especially hard and make voting by mail sometimes virtually impossible. And so those are sort of the structural barriers that, you know, plague Native communities that make it just technically difficult to vote. And then I think the second bucket, which you alluded to in your intro, is unfortunately we see hostility from local county poll workers, clerks, and states across the country towards Native American access. A refusal to put on-reservation polling places or registration opportunities, and a refusal to have Native American poll workers, and some outright disrespectful moves, like in South Dakota, where they insisted that Native Americans vote out of a repurposed chicken coop. So unfortunately, what we see is active discrimination against Native Americans that I think would be surprising to most Americans.
On the structural side of things, you mentioned, you know, reservations, addresses might work differently in ways that election officials or election laws in particular state might not recognize. What do you hope to see when it comes to solutions for that?
Sure. So there's a federal bill right now, the Native American Voting Rights Act, and that bill is actually bipartisan in both the House and the Senate. And what it does is it recognizes that tribes' homes across the country are not addressed and often There's severe overcrowding. So people are moving from home to home, so may not have a permanent address, you know, a lot of couch surfing. And as a result, what NAVRA does is it allows a tribe to designate a building on the reservation that can be used to register, pick up, drop off a ballot. So just allowing folks to overcome that structural barrier. Additionally, you know, we're hoping for an increased attention by the Postal Service and increased funding. President Biden's recent budget proposal included a lot of funding for the Postal Service to increase service in underserved areas like reservations.
On the hostility side of things, some of those examples you gave of just outright, cultural hostility toward Native Americans as they engage with the voting process. In some ways, that seems like a harder problem to solve. What do you do to tackle that?
Absolutely. So I think the problem is when you think about Native American communities, often the legacy is one of folks that you know, there's a colonized community, and then there's, you know, the descendants of colonizers. And that's a really close interaction, and there's a historical legacy of racism and hostility that occurs. And so elections are often run by local officials at that county level. And regardless of sort of larger political affiliations or trends of a state, what you see at the local level is just longstanding prejudices. And so what I think we have to do is mandate that on-reservation access to registration, early voting, election day polling places take place. And that's something that NAVRA does. So it takes the discretion away from those local county officials who are refusing to provide on-reservation access.
We've got these two different kinds of obstacles, as you've laid it out, structural ones, things like the unrecognized addresses, the cultural ones as well. How much of an impact does this have on Native American voters' ability to vote?
Well, unfortunately, Native Americans have the largest discrepancy between eligible voters, percentage-wise, eligible voters and voters that cast a ballot. We have a really large unregistered population and a really low turnout rates in some areas. So these barriers are absolutely impacting the Native vote and unfairly, I think.
What we're talking about is happening at the federal level, this Native American Voting Rights Act. Are there things you're hoping that states do to maybe meet the needs of what might be a unique situation? What might be one thing here in Wisconsin, it might be another, say, in Alaska?
Yeah, so I mean, I think every state should look at every constituent and recognize their value and accommodate the realities of their lives. And we've seen some states take action. For example, Washington State passed its own Native American Voting Rights Act that allowed tribes to do this designating of a building. And we've seen other states make moves to pass their own Native American Voting Rights Act to sort of recognize that their state may have structural problems and then allow litigation to address that. And in all instances, I think all states should recognize tribal IDs and not require an address on those tribal IDs in order to vote.
I mentioned that interagency steering group on Native American voting rights. It sounds like at least the goal was to have a lot of voices at the table. Do you think that on the process side of things, that was successful, that the right people weighed in on some of these issues?
Well, I do think it was a really powerful report. As you say, you know, I think there was a lot of input and outlining of actual discrimination of the different types of barriers that exist. And so I think it was a pretty good deep dive. I will also say, you know, NARF has also done a similar report. We held a series of 9 field hearings across Indian country. And we have an almost 200-page report, Obstacles at Every Turn, Barriers to Political Participation Faced by Native Americans, at vote.narf.org.
In just our last half minute or so, Jacqueline, do you think it's likely that some version of this Native American Voting Rights Act will pass anytime soon?
You know, at the end of the day, NAVRA is bipartisan in both the House and the Senate. I think most Americans recognize that everybody deserves at least a fair shot and the at voting. And so I think that this legislation is distinct. The federal government also has an obligation towards Native Americans that's different than other Americans. There's a federal trust relationship, so they have a lot more leeway to pass voting rights laws. And I definitely think they should, and I definitely think that they can.
Jacqueline, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jacqueline De Leon, an enrolled member of the Isleta Pueblo and a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund. She joined us for a look at the obstacles facing Native American voters and a bill in Congress aimed at tackling at least some of those obstacles. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, where'd the empathy go? A guest makes the case that tough times call for more understanding, but we're not really seeing it. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we learn more about the Biden administration's efforts to regulate home-built firearms and gun kits, sometimes known as ghost guns. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.